If you are interested in the latest trends in the world of booze and bars, Sauce Magazine opens the window to that world every year in its Guide to Drinking edition. This year, no exception, it looks at everything from neighborhood bars to canned wine. Yeah, I said canned wine. Joining me from Sauce Magazine are managing editors Heather Hughes and Catherine Cleaney and staff writer Matt Sorrell. Thank you so much for being with us. And why didn't you bring any samples?
I'm so sorry, Don.
Oversight. Tragic oversight.
Catherine, let me just start with you. Why do we need a guide?
Sure.
This? People seem to be able to find their way pretty well in this area.
The St. Louis bar scene and brewing scene is growing so quickly and so rapidly that once a year we really try to take a moment and really just put the lens on that and what's trending and what's new right now. You know, we focus on drinking in every issue, but just once every year we like in our September issue, we like to really compile it all together and tell people what's new and what you should definitely try right now.
Heather, do you ever feel that you're walking a thin line here? Because in one sense, people certainly want to have this information, but there are folks out there who would probably say, gee, it's encouraging drinking.
Honestly, Don, that's never come to my mind. I think this is actually always my very favorite issue, and I think it's because we work with some really great consultants, and it always ends up being a really content-heavy issue. We cover wine, we cover alcohol, spirits and beer, and we get really into the nuts and bolts of things in a way that we don't always have a chance to do if we're just giving a cocktail recipe or doing like a nightlife review.
Is it your most popular edition? Did I hear that somewhere?
It's one of the most popular.
Beer and Drinking Guide, I think, are our most popular.
Our guide to beer comes out in March, and that's obviously beer focused. But yeah, they're definitely our most popular issues, I think.
And Matt, this of course is a terrible assignment for a writer, right? To have to write about this.
Absolutely. But you do what you got to do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's do what we've got to do and talk about some of the things that are in this this edition. Heather, I guess I'm going to start with you with regard to brandy and let's see, brandy making a comeback, I think, is the way it's billed in the magazine.
I was going to talk more about natural wine.
Oh, you were?
Brandy is more Matt's area.
I beg your pardon. Yeah, let me put on my specs here and find out. So, Matt, I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Not a problem. We kind of dive heavily into brandy this issue. It's obviously an old spirit. It's been around for centuries, but it's not been in favor for a while. It's kind of been eclipsed by things like vodka and specifically bourbon and whatnot now. But it's making a comeback. Bars like Planter's House and Frazier's do some really great things with different types of brandy. For those who don't know, brandy is basically a distillate made from fruit. So we're most commonly thinking about things like grapes, so cognac, Armagnac, but it can be made with any sort of fruit. And we actually have a really great local distillery that started up a couple years ago. It's just now getting its legs, called Elbrand Distilling out in Marthasville, Missouri. And they've been winning a lot of awards lately for their fruit brandies.
We tend to think of brandies, I think, in terms of the old English movies of the gentleman adjourning to the library.
Absolutely.
And their tuxedos or whatever they're wearing at the time.
And I think that's been a problem for the image because it does sort of have a stuffy, you know, it's not hip, it's not now, it's, you know, in fact, Winston Churchill even said that, like, in his father's day, it was always brandy and soda, and then in his generation, it was whiskey and soda. So it's been a while since brandy was in the forefront, but it's coming around.
That's Winston Churchill calling something old.
Right, exactly.
From what I know about Churchill, he was an aficionado of all of them. He was of the above.
He liked his drink.
He certainly did. Okay, Heather, sorry that I had that mix-up there, go ahead with your subject.
Okay, I was going to talk about natural wine. This is a huge trend, and it's kind of silly to call it a trend because it's another thing that is very old. It's going back to the oldest ways of making wine. It's kind of confusing because there's no clear definition. There's no certification that you have to get to say natural on your bottle. And people have different definitions, but generally the motto is nothing added, nothing taken away. So it's people trying to make wine with just, you know, grapes, labor, and time. There are some people who do still add stabilizing ingredients, like people will add a little bit of sulfur at bottling. That's the big infamous thing. Sulfites in wine are frowned upon now. So some natural wines still all have a little bit of naturally occurring sulfites, and then some will still add a little bit, but generally it's nothing added, nothing taken away. And I think if you think about how this works into larger trends, it makes sense that natural wine's coming to the forefront a little bit more. Think about the organic trend, craft trend. This is the craft wine of craft beer or craft cocktails. This is people paying more attention to the way things are made, what they put in their bodies. Natural wine fits into all of that. So the flavor profile of natural wines, because they're made without additives, they're way less consistent. You think about big box wines, something you'd get at Walmart or something. The goal for big companies like that is consistency. You want all your yellowtail to taste the same or whatever. But with natural wines, they're made by smaller producers, and they're going to be much more different from bottle to bottle. It's a little more of a gamble to order a bottle of natural wine.
Well, what about cost? Is it competitive with what we're used to?
There's a huge range. Rachel Schulman from Claverack Farm made the point that some of the oldest, most famous wineries, they're making natural wine because it's just the best way to make wine. Mm-hmm. So some are incredibly expensive. Generally, they're all made by smaller producers, so that can drive up costs. Like, how do you get it? They don't have these avenues of sale, and they don't have such a high market to impetus to make things cheap, you know?
Yeah.
But you can find great natural wine for like $12. Mm-hmm. If you go to Parker's Table, they have a big natural wine selection. Cork and Rind in St. Charles has a good natural wine selection. The Vino Gallery, you can find bottles that are much more affordable.
It sounds like the places to acquire it are few and far between, maybe?
It's harder to find on your grocery store shelves, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not carried by all big distributors.
Specialty shops are the way to go.
Yeah.
When you're looking
right.
for something like this. So go to a place that has is beverage focused mm-hmm. rather than a big grocery store.
But if you went to okay. a place like Total Wine or Randall's, places like that,
they should still have some. It's becoming more popular too. So there's this push to make it more available. It's a trendy word, you
yeah.
know, like if you're a little bit into wine, you'd be like, ooh, natural wine. I've heard of that. So I think Randall's and places like that would want to get into it.
In a restaurant, would you likely find it under a title, natural wine, as opposed to Pinot Noir or
no,
Chardonnay?
That's the tricky thing. A lot of natural wines aren't labeled as such. You'll have to ask some questions.
Okay.
But especially a restaurant that's focused on wine, like Reed's American Table in Maplewood has a great natural wine selection. Mm. And actually the advanced sommelier, Andrei Ivanov, who we've brought on before,
sure. mm-hmm.
Who works at Reed's, said that he thinks Vicia, the new restaurant in the Cortex, has the best natural wine selection in the city.
Okay.
So, yeah, people who are really into food, really into naturally, like organically grown food, are going to be more into natural wine. And then those flavors, because they're grown in similar ways and, you know, the palates have developed together, are going to marry well.
Sure. Well, Catherine Claney, can you get it in a can? I couldn't believe it when I saw them talking about wine in a can.
I don't know that natural wine comes in cans yet.
I am sure some of them do.
I'm sure some of them do. Canned wine sales, though, are booming like never before. There's a lot of, you know, craft beer went back in cans and people were really surprised. And now wine is going back in cans. And it really doesn't affect the taste, and there's a lot of advantages to it. They're very portable. They're perfect for if you're, you know, not it's fall, but it doesn't feel like it. They're perfect for the pool or float trips. You don't need a corkscrew to open it. You don't even need glassware, technically. You could drink it, right? I don't know if sommeliers would agree with that decision, but you could do it. Apparently between summer of 2015 and summer of 2016, the Nielsen company reported that sales of canned wine rose 125% in just 1 year.
Wow.
So it's definitely a very popular thing that they are looking for, and it doesn't really affect the flavor in a way that I think a lot of people would expect it to taste very aluminum, but that's not the case. We tried that alloy wine, right?
Yes,
and
that was our favorite. The rosé, highly recommended.
You know, I've never seen it. I mean, it is available mm-hmm. in the kind of shops that we were talking
mm-hmm.
about before.
Parker's Table has canned wine. It's becoming more popular. And I think it's also, like any trend, it's like the branding is such a big part of that. Yeah. These cans are cute. It's Instagram worthy. People want to take photos mm-hmm. with it, that sort of thing.
I remember I was interviewing Alicia Blackwell Calvert, who is the beverage director at Reed's American Table. And she told me when I asked her about the canned wine trend, she's like, I wanted to hate it. I really wanted to. But then I tried it and I was like, it's good.
It's still just wine.
It's still wine.
Put it in a glass.
Different package.
Matt, you're very silent throughout all of this. What do you think about canned wine?
I think it's fine. I mean, I think, you know, whatever gets you to enjoy your beverage of choice is a good thing. And I like the portability of it, and I think it's really, you know, a great thing to keep around. Somebody comes over, you pop a can, you know, go from there. Yeah.
In terms of its being able to last in the can for long periods of time, its durability, that's... Mm-hmm. I suppose no issue.
Mm-mm.
No.
No issue.
Okay. Let's move on to the next thing, which I have here, which is powdered hops. Again, we're going the artificial route somehow, it seems to me. Let's see. Or maybe it's more than that.
Powdered hops aren't actually artificial. They're still the same hops that you would grow for any other beer production. So there's four key ingredients in beer. There's grain, water, yeast, and hops. And hops are one of the primary ways that your beer gets its distinct flavor. So hops are traditionally grown fresh and then dried and then made into pellet form. That's the most common way that brewers brew beers, with hop pellets, although you will see some fresh hopped beer available. But now what people are playing with is cryogenically frozen hops. So again, still the same product, but it's frozen and then powdered. And so it's Four Hands Brewing in town has done it with a beer called Loose Particles. And it was a sort of juicy Northeast-style IPA that used Simcoe and Mosaic hops that were both powdered. And I was speaking to the brewery manager, Martin Toft, and he said that he really liked it because it's a more concentrated flavor. You don't need as much product to get that same intensity. And they're in terms of portability, it's incredibly lightweight. They're easier to ship, so you can get more for your dollar. So he's definitely planning on playing with it again soon. It's still a fairly experimental product. Second Shift Brewing also played with cryo hops in their Equinaut Experimental IPA earlier this year. But there's a lot of room to experiment and play and just see if this is the new way forward for hops or if it's just another tool in the brewer's toolkit.
I'm not sure that everybody understands what IPA is. It's in the beer world,
sure.
It's a very common term.
An IPA is a style of beer called an India Pale Ale. Mm-hmm. And it's traditionally a, depending on which region you're getting it from, I think the one people are most familiar with is the Northwest IPAs, which tend to be on the bitter side. Mm-hmm. Although there is a sort of growing trend of the Northeast style IPAs, which are much juicier and less bitter. So, but that's the general style. They tend to be much more bitter.
Now we're moving along to the Illinois brewing scene. We never get very far away from the brewing scene
It's a popular scene to be in St. Louis, and I love talking about it.
St. Louis is the beer capital of the world,
absolutely.
I think, in many people's minds. So what's going on in Illinois?
Sure. Well, we've noticed in the past few years, close to a dozen breweries have popped up in Illinois. One particular space that caught our attention is White Rooster Farmhouse Brewery. They opened up last year. They're one of the newest additions to the scene, and people are they're in this teeny little town called Sparta, Illinois. I'm sure people on the Illinois side might be familiar with, but maybe the Missouri folks less so. But people are driving all the way to Sparta. It's about an hour, 15, hour 20, mm-hmm. just to get a taste of these. The owners, Chris Van Horn, Eric Ogilvy, and Mike Deutschman, are home brewers turned pros who decided to open this space up in their hometown. They do farmhouse-style beer, so a lot of barrel-aged, wild-fermented sours, yeast-driven flavors, but they also do those trendier styles like that Northeast IPA I was talking about. Mm. If you're going to head out there, I encourage you to plan accordingly. They are only open Friday evenings and then Saturdays and Sundays starting at noon, and they don't have food, though I think you're allowed to bring it in. Am I right on that?
I think so.
Yeah, you can definitely bring food in, but you need to plan accordingly. Don't show up there on a Wednesday night. I don't think they're going to pour you a drink. Mm. Although they might. I don't know.
We talked a moment ago about IPAs to make sure everybody understood what those letters mean, what they stand for. We're talking about milkshake IPAs now. That's... Whoa.
Just to clarify.
That's not beer.
This is not making a milkshake
and
then adding a beer. That's not what I'm talking about. So recent IPA trends, like I was saying, are dialing down that bitterness. and bringing up these juicier flavors. So a milkshake IPA was sort of a flash trend this summer that we saw that made them more like a dreamsicle. So they're brewed with the trick is they're brewed with fruit and lactose sugar. So a lactose sugar is commonly used in a milk stout, if you're familiar with that brew, and it gives it a very rich, thick mouthfeel. So they took that sugar that you would normally use in a very dark, heavy winter brew and put it in an IPA, and that gives it that same creamy mouthfeel, but with fruity, citrusy kind of flavors.
There are a lot of people out there really messing around with this stuff and coming up with really different ideas and totally counterintuitive.
Well,
in
I think
many
that's
occasions.
The fun with the drinking scene in this town is you can take your, in the case of beer, you take a base recipe and throw in all your different adjuncts and barrels and you get completely different things. With cocktails, you take your base spirit, a couple of mixers. I mean, Matt's been in the bartending industry for years, and it's just the ability to be creative is so fun.
Speaking of counterintuitive, I see in the notes here that we're going to be talking about a German Pinot Noir, which doesn't quite fit somehow.
It doesn't. No? Yes, so German Pinot Noirs are becoming more and more popular, and as you implied, that wasn't always the case. I think the best way to think about this is, so wines that are grown in very warm climates tend to be fruitier, juicier, sweeter, which I think intuitively makes a little bit of sense. And wines that are grown in colder regions tend to be a little more acidic, brighter, and that, like, think about fresh, cold feeling. That's kind of how the wine tastes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pinot Noirs usually were much more acidic, maybe a little bit thin. But because of the way the climate's been changing, their Pinot Noirs are warming up a little bit, getting a little fruitier, and people are really into it. They've become very popular, so that was one of our trend pieces this year was German Pinot Noir.
And Matt, we're going to turn to you for the frozen and blended drinks, correct?
Yes. Well, frozen and blended drinks kind of get a bad rap a lot of times. They're kind of equated with bad nights on Bourbon Street or spring break issues. But actually, frozen drinks and mixed drinks in blenders have been around for a while, and they're sort of making a comeback, especially on the quality side of things. There's several places around town that are doing really good versions. Narwhal's Crafted Urban Ice has a really nice menu. They have a watermelon frosé that's absolutely nice. The Preston in the Chase Park Plaza has been doing a lot of frozen and blended drinks, especially during this pool season. The Libertine Pirano has had a Negroni slushy on the menu since they opened, and I've been told that's not going away ever.
A lot of them selling well during the recent heat wave.
Absolutely.
Oh, for sure.
Kind of thing. And finally, in just a few seconds we have left, fine dining and craft beer. They go together very nicely,
they
right?
do. They do. The wine list has always had top billing at fine dining restaurants, but beer in its in infinite forms, as you've been talking about, is really getting a place in the spotlight. We're seeing a lot of quality bottles showing up on restaurants like Vicia, Olive & Oak, Sardella, and then even breweries are partnering with fine dining restaurants to make beers just for them. Perennial Artisan Ales is a great example of a local brewery who's done specialty brews for Olive & Oak, Farmhouse, and Juniper. So there's definitely a lot of great beer that pairs with some wonderful food here in town.
Okay, we've been talking about drinking, good places to do it, and what to drink with our friends from Sauce Magazine, Catherine Cleaney, Heather Hughes, and Matt Sorrell. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Thank you.
Don.
Right,
thanks so much. And archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.